I wanted to begin today with a couple of programming notes. First of all, this episode was recorded only about a week and a half ago, but it was long before we had all felt the major effects of COVID-19. Schools were just hinting at closing. Things were still relatively normal. And while I was editing this episode today and yesterday, I was really thinking about how quaint and cute we were and how far away it seemed. Hopefully this upbeat episode brings some normalcy to your crazy lives right now. Secondly, I would really like to try to do a Voices of Quarantine episode, and here's how it would work. Please use the Voice Memo app on your phone to record yourself, and maybe even your kids or other people that you live with, singing a fish-related song, telling a fishing story or a fishy story, a fish joke even, just whatever light fish-related content you can think of. I want to compile them into an episode to put out in a couple of weeks. So do your thing. Get recording. The deadline to be included in the episode will be April 10th at midnight. Send entries to julie.vecchio, that's V-E-C-C-H-I-O, at thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope we can have some fun together. And now on to the show. Thank you for joining me. I am Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, please follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head on over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. Our show is free, but the internet is not. It costs us about $30 a month to keep the show on the internet. So if you'd like to help us offset that cost, please consider becoming a patron like Bob K. My guest today is Allie Putnam. Allie is a PhD student at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in the Marine Global Change Ecology Lab with Dr. Brian Cheng. Her research focuses on species interactions in the context of climate change. Questions she's investigating include, how will warming waters induce range expansion in southern distribution species in the Gulf of Maine? And how will those temperature influence current predator-prey and competitive interactions currently occurring between benthic invertebrate species in the Gulf of Maine? She's passionate about marine ecology, species interactions, and how various aspects of climate change play a part in a dynamic marine systems and interactions. She's also enthusiastic about STEM education, diversity, equality, and inclusion in the STEM fields, and is a co-founder of the local organization in her area, the Pioneer Valley Women in STEM. Welcome to the podcast, Allie. I'm so excited to get to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here for sure.
So let's just jump right into it. What is your sort of origin story? What got you first interested in science?
Yeah, that's a really good question that I love to talk about. So I have always been interested in the natural world. I was born and partially raised in a really urban city in Springfield, Massachusetts. My parents eventually picked us up and moved from the city into a really, really, really rural farm town. So we went from having neighbors that were super close to being on like a 4-acre property with fields and chickens and horses and all kinds of wild animals in the back. So I grew up the rest of my life on the farm, exploring outside, spending a lot of time in nature. It was something that just gave me peace. And I was always curious about all the bugs that I would find. My parents always talk about how I used to go out into the woods and then come back with handfuls of various small snakes, and they would be quite upset. And I was like, hey, look what I've got. So you know, slithering creatures, weird bugs, toads, frogs. So just kind of like a natural passion for the environment and for the natural world. It was actually this veterinarian who really encouraged me to pursue science. So I was homeschooled and spent a lot of time at home learning, and we had large animals, and we had this veterinarian who would come out and she would, you know, float the horse's teeth and give vaccinations, and all the while that she was there, I was always asking questions like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And she entertained all the questions that I had and would always talk to me about the science behind what she was doing.
Sounds like my son.
Yeah.
He's three and he's constantly like, but why? But why?
Yes,
but
yes.
Why? But
that
why?
But why? Yeah, I think I actually ended up killing a couple toads when I was younger because of the but why question, which was like, but why can't they go and stay in water the way frogs can? So yeah, lots of but why questions. And I really admire this veterinarian for answering all my questions with a smile on her face. And so it was her encouragement around science. And she actually invited me to shadow her weekly during my high school years while I was homeschooled. And I think that was the uniqueness of being homeschooled, is that flexible schedule. Every Monday, I would be out on the road with her, age 14 through age 17. Every Monday out on the road with her, learning, asking questions, all those but why questions. And she was the one who was like, hey, you should really go to college. You should really think about studying science. You seem really interested in it. And if you're interested in veterinary medicine, you know, you should consider pursuing science. So I'd say that my, you know, initial interest in science comes from who I am, you know, my genetic makeup, my personality, coupled with having a few key people in my life, like that veterinarian who showed up at that impressionable moment for me as a youngster to say, hey, like, you should pursue this and like go forth and do. I didn't really have too many other people in my life saying that's what you should go and do. And I didn't really know anything otherwise.
That's incredible. That's really amazing. So she was a large animal veterinarian and going around and helping out the horses and cows and everything?
Yeah, she was an incredible person. And actually I reflect on her often, even to today, because I think back to when she was wrestling horses. I mean, I'm not kidding you. This woman would like wrestle a horse. And she was like, I remember she was pregnant twice during that time period that I was working with her. And she would be out there like 8 months pregnant, still wrestling with horses. And so as a person who is in science and science and within my own education and having had my kids while I did all of that, you know, I think back to her being that figure who showed me like, she's not only a mom, but she's also a pregnant mom. And she's still out here being a, you know, superstar veterinarian scientist.
So she really got you thinking about going to college. And you said you're a first generation college student and the first person in your family to pursue science as a career. So when you decided to do that, what was the reaction in your family?
So it was kind of like one of those mixed reactions of like, well, why? But then also like, okay, well, if that's what you want to do, you're going to have to figure it out because we don't really know how to, you know, help you through that. So it was kind of a mixed reaction. And so I really had to take a lot of initiative and do a lot of self-teaching on what I needed to do to get into college. It was actually really intimidating, to be honest with you. You know, I applied to a couple of four-year schools and got in, but I don't think I really had the support that I needed to say like this was going to be okay, both the accepting four-year college and on the giving, you know, support system on my side. I didn't end up doing four-year school because of that intimidation.
That definitely makes sense. I mean, to be honest, I'm from a relatively educated family, but when I was looking at going to college, you know, the thought of going far from my parents too was just so intimidating. I ended up choosing one that was only about an hour away because mm-hmm. I just couldn't even imagine going any farther from where they were, even though from a really young age, I knew I wanted to be a marine biologist and I was in Michigan, but I couldn't possibly go that far away from them. So just the intimidation and the distance of college sometimes can be a real barrier.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And so I ended up picking a local community college to go to, which, you know, looking back at it, was definitely a great decision. I felt slightly disappointed because the stigma around community college is that it's a less than, you know, I felt like slightly disappointed in myself that I was choosing to go to a community college. But hindsight is totally 20/20, right? And when I look back at it, you know, the community college experience was by far the most transformative thing that I could have done for myself. And then, you know, I saved a lot of money. And then what I know about community colleges, having worked in higher education and worked for a community college, community colleges are definitely where it's at. And the narrative has definitely changed over the last, you know, like 10 years or so. But initially for me, when I made that decision, I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is what I'm doing. And each year, you know, after my first year, I was like, I'm going to apply to a four-year school and transfer because that's what I'm supposed to do. And then, you know, that year I was like, actually, maybe I'm not ready. This is too intimidating still. And so I ended up staying the full 2 years and doing the associates at my community college.
I don't really understand the stigma. Yeah. And because in a lot of cases, you really do get a really excellent education within the community college system, especially ones that have the kind of the resources available. A lot of times you get to have much smaller classes than you would at a large state university and much more personal interactions. The instructors don't care any less. They probably care a lot more because that's their primary job is education. So you completed your associates and then your bachelor's, and then you went on for a master's. What was the reaction in your family then?
So my journey is actually very non-traditional. So, you know, when I went to my community college, I was the traditional, just finished high school age. When I went to transfer from my 2 year to my 4 year school, I was the traditional age. It was a hard transition, I'm not going to lie, going from a community college to a really strong school like Smith College, both like socially and academically prepared, but it just was overwhelming and it was a lot. And during my first year at Smith, as a traditional transfer student, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. And for those who don't know what Crohn's disease is, that is a gastrointestinal autoimmune disorder where basically our bodies hate ourselves and attacks, you know, our GI tract to some degree or another.
I also have Crohn's disease.
Yes.
And yeah, my immune system hates me sometimes, especially when I'm really stressed.
I was stressed during my first year at Smith. So coupled with imposter syndrome of being a first gen poor community college student at this amazing all women's powerful institution, flopped. So I did my first year at Smith. I withdrew afterwards. So I didn't complete my bachelor's at the traditional age. And in between, you know, a couple years after that, my partner and I, we got married and we had two kids. And it wasn't until my daughter was almost a year old that I was like sitting, taking care of her. And I was thinking, gosh, I really want to finish my degrees because that is something that has been important to me since I was a young kid. And my partner is super, super supportive. And he was like, you want to go back? Let's do it. And Smith College, outside of their traditional students who attend the school, they have a program for non-traditional students called the Ada Comstock Scholar Program. This program is for students who are non-traditional age or who have families. So I had, you know, emailed Smith saying, you know, I really would like to come back to school. I know it's been many years. What do I do? What are the next steps? And they were like arms wide open. They're like, come back. You're going to be an Ada Comstock scholar. We'll support you. And so I actually went back to finish my bachelor's with two kids, ages 1 and 2.5.
Wow. What kinds of specific accommodations do they have for non-traditional students with families? Yeah. Are the classes at different times?
What makes them unique is that they provide a significant portion of funding for the Ada Comstock scholars. So they're really generous with their financial aid. My tuition was covered, and then they provide a stipend to help you live. So like I used the stipend to pay for a babysitter so that I could go to class. And sometimes I would take my kids to class if my babysitter was sick. And so, yeah, basically they just really, they cover a lot for you financially. We live in the local area. So I, you know, we had an apartment and we lived at our apartment, but for Ada Comstock scholars who are coming from all over, you know, the world, they have housing, specific housing that keeps the cohorts together, which is really important to have that like support system of people who are similar to you so that they can continue to live their life with their families, but also finish their education, and which then turned into a master's. I was taking ecology classes during my last year of my bachelor's as an adult. And that's when I realized that I was super interested in ecology and that I really love thinking about systems and species and how organisms use space and habitat and interact with each other or interact. And so I started taking as many ecology classes as I possibly could during that last year. And one of them was a really, really fun coral reef ecology class that I took with Professor Paulette Peckel. It was after the class ended and I graduated that she approached me during that last portion of the year saying, you know, I know that you're an Ada Comstock scholar. I know that your background is a little bit different than my traditional students. And it sounds like you haven't had much of a research experience. I want to invite you to be part of my research program during the summer, to which I was like, yes, of course. Like, I'm absolutely interested in that. I'm passionate about the ocean. I've been scuba diving since I was a teenager. I live in New England, so the ocean is not too far from me. And so I had an opportunity to get involved in some marine science research with this faculty member. So she brought me on. We started doing work during the summer. It was really fantastic. We had a great working relationship. She was a fantastic mentor. And the work that we were doing was really fun and informative. It was Paulette who said, hey, have you ever considered doing a master's? And I was like, what is a master's? And after some thorough explanation, I realized that it was the right choice for me. And so she took me on as her master's student. It was really a transformative experience and one that made me realize that science is totally where I wanted to be with my life. Marine science was where I wanted to be with my life. And that she gave me the tools to become a researcher and the skills helped me build my skills, which now I'm using today in my PhD.
I'm just struck by the number of fantastic mentors that you've been able to work with. And that's so encouraging. Such great stories to hear about. Yeah. You know, the people that really, really care about not only science, but people and bringing people along and helping people and everything like that, you know?
Yeah. I feel really fortunate to have had a couple of key people. You know, they're the people who open the door. I could be the brightest person in the world, but if I don't know how to access what's behind the door, then I can never get there, right? By having people who know systems and no higher education and no science, the systems within science who also want to be the people who are inclusive and bring people in and care about people along with the science. You know, someone like me really benefits from that.
What kinds of insights did your master's work give you about the marine invaders that you were studying? You were looking at some snails and some invasive crabs and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was such a fun project. I really loved that. I had no idea I was going to love snails so much. So basically, you know, I was interested in understanding how these two intertidal marine snail species interact with each other because they looked like their distribution had some level of overlap within the rocky intertidal. So I spent time designing experiments to get at what kind of interaction could be happening, and found out that there is in fact an interaction occurring to some degree between these two snail species where one is inducing a chemical response in a food resource, which impacts the grazing of the other snail species. And then when you throw these crabs in the mix, you know, that changes the interaction and the strength of interaction. And so, yeah, just really fascinating information in thinking about how grazers use the intertidal and then how predators can influence how these grazers interact with their food resource and interact with each other. So we've got our players are the green crab and the Asian shore crab, both of which are invasive crab species, one being more recent in their introduction, like, you know, the 1980s or so with the Asian shore crab versus green crab coming in the 1800s. And so they both have different life history strategies. They both have different levels of tolerance for their environment. And both of them are predators to these two snail species. And so it was interesting to find out information about the responses of the snails to these predators and how one snail species doesn't have much of a response in their grazing to one crab species, but does to the other. And so if they're having this response where they stop grazing and hunker down, what does that mean for their interaction with the other snail species that they are competing with? So if anything, the whole project was very eye-opening to the complexity of species interactions and how you can have things like competition and coexistence occurring along with responses to predation. That wasn't even taking into consideration any environmental factors such as, you know, temperature and how climate change could impact these interactions. So I gained a lot of insight, prepared me for the future work that I would end up doing for my PhD.
Yeah, so let's move into that because this is the fisheries podcast after all, not the snail podcast. Snails are important, but fisheries. Yeah. So your current work is focusing on the interactions between two important fishery species in the Gulf of Maine and coastal New England. Can you describe a little bit about what you're studying now in your PhD?
I, as an ecologist, am still really interested in species interactions. I'm still rather new. I'm in my first year at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I'm in a program called Organismic and Evolutionary Biology, and I'm working with Dr. Brian Chang. Again, interested in species interactions, thinking about them in the context of climate change. I decided to focus on lobsters because I'm in New England. The lobster fisheries is a really, really important fishery to New England and the states of New England, the local economies, and then, you know, is one of the largest fisheries within North America. There's a lot of really fascinating research occurring with lobsters at the various institutions in New England. And so I'm a new person stepping into this world, but really thinking about it in the context of species interactions and how climate change will influence that.
I think that's a really, really important direction to be looking at it from, because you know what? A lot of these old guys have been looking at lobsters for decades. They don't have that kind of perspective. They just have, let's look at the graph and the numbers and see what's happening. And a very traditional fisheries lens, I think bringing new skills and new insights and new directions to the table is just going to benefit everybody.
Yeah, that's something that I, you know, as I've been meeting various people within this field, that I've noticed that the species interaction topic is not as talked about, which, you know, as someone who's new to fisheries, I'm just a listener and I'm observing the people who have been doing this for a long time. And I, you know, really respect the work that they do. And it's really useful to be thinking about also when I'm thinking about the things I'm interested in, such as species interactions.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for two decades, probably we've known that we need to incorporate other species into stock assessments and that sort of thing and take their interactions and their place in the ecosystem into account, but nobody can really figure out how to do that well. And so someone like you stepping in to be able to bring this different perspective might really be able to advance the science in a significant way.
My intention for this work is to do good ecological science, but I also want to be useful to the people who are working in the lobster fisheries and the management. And so that's something that I'm sort of like straddling the line right now as I've been developing my experiments and thinking about the work that I'm going to be doing this field season and for future field seasons, that, you know, I just really want to be mindful of as I do my work, that I want it to be useful in both contexts. So,
and you're looking as well at the range expansion in black sea bass?
Yes. Yeah. So that's something that is part of the, well, part of the lobster story that I've been thinking about anyways, is this range expansion of black sea bass into the Gulf of Maine. They're very present in southern New England, and there's been conversation with fishermen that black sea bass are showing up in traps and on lines in the Massachusetts Bay, but then also farther north into the Gulf of Maine, out in the coastal Maine area. I've heard people say, oh, you know, we catch lobster and the ones that we throw over the side that we can't keep because they're too small, you know, we're not even sure they make it to the bottom because they're being gobbled up by black sea bass.
Oh, the big bad predator.
Yeah. Right.
We have the same. So this is a totally different size scale, but here in the Gulf of Mexico and the West Florida Shelf, the Goliath grouper.
Oh yeah.
They're massive, right? They're like, mm-hmm. They can get like 6 feet long. They were pretty much almost fished to extinction throughout their range. They've been protected for like 30 years and now they're starting to come back. Well, they really, really like to hang around shallow artificial reefs and places where people really want to fish for like other groupers and snappers. Well, of course, they're also really lazy. If they can bite and eat a fish that's already hooked, they're going to. And so all the fishermen are totally up in arms about how the Goliath grouper are eating all the fish on the entire reef. There's not going to be any left ever again because you're letting them come back. It's the standard story of the big bad predator.
Yeah.
Everybody thought they wanted back until suddenly it comes back.
You know, there's thought that black sea bass are, you know, consuming these smaller lobsters, but there hasn't been too much in terms of like quantifying that. There's been some previous work on black sea bass and lobsters in terms of behavior and how black sea bass will, you know, change lobster behavior, which is really, really fascinating. I'm thinking about how, you know, what is their strength of predation? How does that change with varying temperature? And so this summer, that's going to be one of the things that I'm focusing on, is these temperature manipulation and predation experiments, acclimating both lobsters and black sea bass to different temperature treatments, and then inducing an interaction and quantifying the rates of the interaction. So escape velocity by lobster and attack velocity by black sea bass. What are the individual responses at varying temperatures? And is there a winner and a loser?
Yeah. I think one of the other things that the fishermen need to keep in mind is that black sea bass are damn tasty too. We need to start catching those things up there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. I was thinking that maybe this could be the development of a new fisheries. I've never eaten a black sea bass myself. I don't actually really like to eat seafood, to be honest with you. I just don't really like the taste. And some people kind of tease me about that.
That is one of the advantages to studying fish. You get to eat your study organism. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, each to their own. We've done similar things with lionfish here. Their populations really exploded and took off, you know, after they were introduced in the last 15 years or something. Their populations just exploded. And so there are consistent rodeos and, you know, fishing tournaments and stuff like that where they catch as many lionfish as possible. And they're damn tasty too. So then they just cook them all up and eat them. They actually get a pretty good price in the market.
There's this great cookbook out there that I've heard of called Eat That Invasive. I'm pretty sure that I've seen a lionfish recipe on that. And snails, the snails that I was studying previously, it end up in a recipe in that book. But, you know, thinking about predation on lobsters. And I've talked with various people who have said that, you know, predators, predation are not really included in the modeling and the projections for the fisheries. And so, you know, I'm hoping that some of my work can be informative. You know, I think about like the whole ecosystem, right? What's happening in the whole ecosystem for lobsters. And I'm not necessarily thinking about predation on lobsters that are 80 millimeter carapace length or larger. I'm thinking about the smaller juvenile lobsters and the early benthic phase lobsters, the ones that are post-larval that start to settle towards the bottom that are like 5 to 25 millimeter carapace length. And what's happening for them as they settle at the bottom? Who is eating who? And what could that look like long term? And what kind of influence will that have on the larger population? So lots and lots and lots of questions that I hope to continue to dive in and explore over my field seasons over the next several years.
So you're doing some amount of captive work. Are you also going to be doing some field work with this project?
Potentially. I've got some brainstorming to do. You know, I think a little bit about previous experiments that other scientists have done that include tethering of lobsters. That's something to explore. Right now, I'm just trying to figure out the logistics of lab work. So our field station or our lab is out in Gloucester, Mass., which is pretty far away from where I actually live. So right now my main focus is thinking about the logistics of what the lab work is going to look like. But yes, there will be some field components that I'm just in the middle of developing.
So it seems like throughout your scientific and your educational career, you've had a lot of different types of experiences. So if you were going to go sit down with some friends in the bar after, you know, just having a beer on Friday night or whatever, and you were about to start a story with, "No shit, there I was," what would the rest of the story be?
I have quite a few of them, to be honest with you. It's amazing. And, you know, I have to like laugh at myself when I think back to some of these stories of like the oh shit stories while I've been out. But I'd say like there's this distinct moment where I was scuba diving up here in New England. And so most of my diving over the last 15, 20 years has been cold New England water. And that's what I'm used to. So the first time that I ever went diving somewhere warm, like the tropics, I literally cried underwater because I was just so taken away by the beauty, the clear water, and how warm it was, and that I was not in 7 to 14 millimeters of neoprene.
I'm pretty used to it.
Yeah.
I did a lot of my early diving in Southern California, and man, I can barely go back there now.
Yeah. Well, so I was diving up here in New England and I was looking for lobsters. I was, you know, probably 19 or so, and I wasn't catching lobsters. I just was looking for them. I did a lot of just exploratory diving, and I was, you know, moving along, and I like felt like something was watching me. It's pretty cloudy in our area where we dive. And, you know, on a good day, maybe you can see 15 feet in front of you. But I'm pretty sure at that moment, I could only see about 5 feet in front of me. And so, but I felt like something was following me, and it was kind of eerie feeling. And my dive partner was off actually collecting lobsters. I was swimming along, really felt something over my shoulder. Started looking under rocks, looking for lobsters. I found this incredibly large lobster that, you know, everything is bigger underwater, but I'm pretty sure was like the size of my abdomen. And then I finally like stop, turn, and there's this like 3.5 foot long striper that scared the ever living daylights out of me, that I actually like, you know, squealed underwater because I just was not expecting to see such a large fish that, literally like 2 feet from the back of my head. I moved along after I finally recovered from my scare, and this striper followed me for a good 20 minutes as I'm putzing around this cove, just doing my own thing. And I don't know why, I don't know what it was all about, but it was definitely like a no shit, there I was, just minding my own business. And this fish would not leave me alone.
Do you ever have seals follow you around?
To be honest with you, I have never, in my 15, 20 years of diving, I have never had a seal approach me. I've never actually even physically seen one while I've been diving.
I've never dove in New England. Just in Southern California, they used to come up to us all the time.
Oh, that would just be wild.
Yeah,
oh,
they'd get it right up in your face. That's just like crazy. Look right in your eyes.
I can only imagine that, because after that one experience with that striped bass, I just was like floored by how brazen it was to just come right up to me and then follow me for a good 20 minutes after.
Pivoting away from research here, I like to talk to guests a lot about other things that maybe sort of make them. We've talked a lot about your academic background and that, and that's really fascinating and how a lot of people have really helped you along the way. But you also are the founder or the co-founder of the Pioneer Valley Women in STEM group. Can you tell me a little bit about that organization?
I am one of the co-founders. There are three other women who started this group with me. Beth McGinnis Kavanaugh, Melissa Pachulli, and Michelle Raim. We started this group in 2018. I was working at a community college in Western Massachusetts, Greenfield Community College, in their science department. And Beth works at Springfield Technical Community College. Melissa works at Holyoke Community College. And Michelle also was working at Holyoke Community College while also finishing her bachelor's degree in engineering. We've been working in these community colleges serving STEM students, and all of us are women in STEM. And we realized that there was no group in Western Massachusetts that unified and united all of the women in STEM across education professionals, how important it is to be supporting women in STEM. And so initially we were thinking about our community college students. And so we kind of all came together because our colleges are, you know, not too far apart from each other. Our paths crossed multiple times due to the various work, the nature of our work that we do at the community colleges. And we were like, hey, we should start this group. And really, it was Beth and Melissa who kind of started things and then absorbed a couple of us in as the ideas started to roll. Then Pioneer Valley Women in STEM was born. So what our group is unify women in STEM from all across Western Massachusetts. And actually, our range is sort of expanding beyond those limits as we have more of a presence on social media and at conferences and whatnot. So, but it unites women in STEM across the levels of education, high school girls, women at community colleges, women at four-year schools, women in graduate school, women who work as academics, women who work in professional STEM careers. It unites them all together. The purpose of our group is to support all of these women at wherever they are in their journey through empowerment, engagement, and connecting women together to each other. So basically, we're a regional network of identifying women in STEM that accept, understand, encourage, and empower women and girls at all and from all STEM entry points. All of us co-founders, we have non-traditional educational pathways. Most of us are first gen, went to school with kids, that type of background. And we're passionate about increasing equity, access, and advancement for women in all STEM fields at all levels of their journey. We basically are like the connector. A lot of institutions have their own little branches of women groups. So either like Society of Women Engineers have little pockets of groups at colleges, or there's, you know, graduate women in science pockets at different institutions. And some companies even have developed their own small women in STEM or women in tech groups that get together. But what we do is we bring all the groups and all the individuals together. So we kind of envision ourselves as like a bicycle wheel with the spokes, you know, that we're the hub and we kind of just bring everyone together. And so we have get-togethers, you know, informal social get-togethers where we have some cocktails or some snacks and just chat about the day-to-day life of being a woman in STEM. Then we also put on these really large events where we have anywhere between 60 to 150 people attend that are more along the lines of sort of like professional development and networking, where people get together, they get to interact with each other over food and drinks, and then we have a speaker, and then we have breakout sessions. So it's more of a learning environment for those big events. When you support people who have not always had access to STEM, and you support those people, we can make changes in STEM and we can evolve what's happening in science, technology, engineering, and math by bringing diverse people to the table who can contribute.
Making things so much more accessible is just, it's better for everybody.
It's been a really fun journey. We have 300 people that we support and engage and interact with within our community. And that number just keeps increasing and keeps growing. And we realize that there's a lot of significance in connecting with each other, sharing stories and sharing experiences so that other people feel empowered by what someone else has done and then can believe that they can do it themselves. And so, you know, Massachusetts, the governor this past year declared the theme for STEM Week, which he has been promoting for the last 2 years, as See Yourself in STEM. And that's something that we talk a lot about with Pioneer Valley Women in STEM, is that our local community need to see themselves in STEM. And so we do that by promoting and uplifting women who are in these areas of STEM so that the rest of our community can see what's happening, what they do, and can feel empowered and encouraged to go and do it themselves. We're in the process of becoming a nonprofit with all the paperwork and whatnot. And eventually we'd like to be able to have financial lines of support for students and other women in STEM as well. So we've got some really big thoughts for our group about how we can best serve our community and the community outside of our community.
So in either one of these realms, either your marine science, marine ecology realm, or in supporting and uplifting women across STEM, if money was not an issue, what's one project that you would love to work on in the future, thinking really big?
In my science sphere, if money were not an issue, I would attempt to clone myself so that I had more time. You know, there's so many ideas and so many concepts that can be explored that I wish that I had more time, more of me. There's just so many things that interest me. And honestly, money can't buy me time, right? I wish that it could. And within the realm of Pioneer Valley Women in STEM, if money were not an issue, we would probably host more events than we previously have. You know, we have our events twice a year where we spend the money, our grant funding, to hold these events. And then our smaller social gatherings are usually people show up at a restaurant kind of thing. But if money were not an issue, we'd probably host more events with, you know, like all day long type events instead of short evening events. And if money weren't an issue, we would have loads of funding to create scholarship lines to support students. We would help transport people in rural Western Mass to be able to come to our events, because that's one of the issues. Even though we have a small state, it is pretty rural in Western Mass. And so transportation can be challenging for a lot of people to get to various places. If money weren't an issue, I'd clone myself so I could continue to do all the science. And then I would just give money to students to support them to do all the science.
So outside of science and empowering others to do science, what are your hobbies, or what feeds you? What do you do when you need to step away from all things science, or what do you wish you could do more of?
I really like to run. So I do like to physically be active. Running, I was into Brazilian jiu-jitsu for a little while until I almost broke my neck. And then after that, I had to give that a break because I realized that I'm no longer young and as flexible as I used to be. I like to be active. I like to physically do things, exercise and such. I think it's about like getting those good endorphins going. But then also it feeds my soul in the sense that it allows me to like not focus on all the things that want my attention. I can just focus on being outside. I try to choose places to run that have things to look at. So I'll go trail running and I really love to run through the woods. And one particular area that I run at usually has a lot of deer and a lot of wildlife. So try to run near reservoirs just so that I can be out in nature while physically taking some stress out of my body by running. So I do consider my work and engagement with the Pioneer Valley Women in STEM, I'm not going to consider it a hobby, but the enjoyment and the like feeding of my soul that you were explaining, like I really do get that from that type of work by knowing that I'm contributing to the world.
Yeah. I mean, not that science and work and activities like that can, not that they can't, but sometimes right. You just need to step away from it all.
Yeah.
If you can manage it. So we're both mothers who are pursuing our PhDs. Mine is, oh my God, I just got all of my signatures. It's so done.
I'm so happy for you.
I can't even believe it. I never thought this day would come. But anyway, it does eventually. Yeah. It does. You said you finished your bachelor's when your kids were 1 and 3-ish.
Yep.
And so now they're a little older. They're in elementary school.
Yeah. Yep. My son is 8 and a half and my daughter, is a little over 7. It's definitely quite the experience, doing this type of work with children in tow. I mean, so when I was doing my master's, they were like 3, 4, 5, 6 in that age range. It was different then because a 3-year-old, my 3-year-old didn't mind sitting, in the stroller in the lab, watching Finding Nemo while I was, changing water for an experiment that I was running. Right.
Oh my God. My 3-year-old would mind.
Yeah.
My 3-year-old would want his hands in the water and running around doing laps around the lab. I can't even imagine.
That's my 3-year-old son for sure.
Yeah.
So I would, here's a little plastic Tupperware container with a green crab in it. Just don't lose your finger. Here you go. Mm-hmm. And yep. He would play with the green crab while my daughter would just sit there watching Finding Nemo.
Oh God. Yeah. I don't
But they,
the differences in kids.
Yes, totally. They essentially from a young age has been them experiencing me in a degree program or working at an academic institution to some degree or another. It's sort of their norm. It really, it has its challenges. I think that one of the key things for me has been, the support of my advisors as being a parent in an academic program. Okay, like I know your kids are sick. Like, it's okay. I'll do this. You take care of that. Or yeah, we'll be flexible on this timeline because of, your kids. Or yes, your kids are welcome to come out into the field, those types of things. And my current PhD advisor is just as supportive in knowing that, I have my children. And so I have to balance being a researcher, being an educator, and being a parent at the same time. And so his belief in me that I can be a good scientist and a good parent together is really vital because I can believe that. And I do believe that. I believe that I can be a really good scientist, the best that my physical and intellectual capabilities allow me to be. And I can be a really, really good parent too. And I can believe that all day long, but if I don't have people in my corner who also believe that, it's just fighting an uphill battle, right? Because there's lots of different logistical components of being in a PhD program. Like, okay, I'm going to do research out at the field station this summer. What do I do with my kids? Components like that. So to have someone who is willing to problem solve and be flexible is really the key. So, like my kids have spring break. Actually, they have so many breaks. They've got like a February break, they've got a April break, and then they've got days off for professional development and such. And so, child care can be challenging. And so a lot of times this past year, I have asked for permission of my faculty if I could bring my kids to class. So I, you know, pack up their backpacks of their coloring stuff, their book, a computer, those types of things. And my kids have sat through hours of ecology and evolution courses, hours of statistics classes, and the faculty who teach those classes have been inclusive of me as a parent. You know, when I say, oh my gosh, my babysitter's sick, I either can't come to class, or, you know, we can Zoom in, or I can bring them, you know, they've always been like, yeah, if you can manage it, we're fine with that. And, you know, that's been really, really key is, and I feel like that's sort of been the theme of this conversation, that there are people who do all of this incredible scientific work and who progress the field of science, but that they also care about other people, help other people get to those places and allow them to do those things. I feel really, really fortunate that I've got an advisor and that I work with faculty who have that on their mind to be inclusive.
Really, really heartening to hear and to know that there are so many different people out there that are actively promoting the inclusion of people who might look a little bit different or have a lifestyle or, you know, a life situation that's different from sort of the traditional. It's really good to know. And it's good that these things are starting to happen throughout marine science.
Yeah, definitely. And I have to say, it's been really enriching for my kids. They have learned so much. I can't believe, I want to say it was like a couple months ago that we were sitting down having dinner and my son started talking to me about phylogenetic relatedness and evolution. And I was like, what? And he's like, oh yeah, you know, today when we were talking in your class.
Yeah, when we went to class.
Yeah. And I was like, oh yeah. And then, you know, he started telling me about his ideas about this species being related to that species and where the common ancestor is. And I was like, you took all of that away from today's class? I was like, I thought you were focusing on Mario Kart. He's like, no, I was listening. Yeah. And then my daughter, there's actually a lot of women in some of my statistics classes. And it's one of my classes that I'm taking, applied ecological statistics is taught by a woman faculty member, which is fantastic. And so my daughter's been talking a lot about math and how she's interested in math and how the classes that she's gone to with me about that, you know, she wants to combine math and her love for art and like maybe do something with engineering. And I was like, wow, I can't believe you guys absorb this stuff when we're out like this.
That's so amazing. That feeds my soul right there. Yeah. It definitely does.
Little scientist in the making.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
So we're down to sort of the end of the episode. And this is the part of the episode where we ask each of our guests a few final questions. The original first question was, what's your favorite fish? But I found that to be just not quite enough.
Yeah.
So this idea has stuck in my mind for a long time. I first ran across it in a 1996 book by Dr. Milton Love. The book was called Probably More Than You Wanted to Know About Fishes of the Pacific Coast. Even if you don't live on the Pacific Coast, it's freaking hilarious. You should pick it up. And so published in 1996, so it's got these color plates in the middle. And one of only like 20 pages of color plates was his fish tattoos. And he sort of famously said, a true biologist will have a tattoo of their favorite organism on their body. So my question to you is, do you have any fish tattoos?
So I am tattooed. I love tattoos. I have several tattoos in my body that most of them are actually related to my scientific work. I don't currently have a fish tattooed on me, although my plan was to have a parrotfish tattooed on me somewhere. I just am like working that out with my sleeve designer. So, but right now what I do have tattooed on my body, on my right upper shoulder, is actually one of my research sites from out in coastal Maine. So it's got the like rocky intertidal oceanscape, the jagged rocks and scrubby plants on the side. And then as you follow my arm down, I actually have a ghost crab tattooed on my bicep for multiple reasons. So I love invertebrates and will probably have several more invertebrates tattooed on myself, probably a lobster, also a snail, but I really love ghost crabs. My kids and I love to go to North Carolina and look for them at night. I also think about ghost crabs. They're really fast and very pinchy. And my kids are also really fast and really pinchy with their attitude sometimes. So my ghost crab is like a two-way meaning of like, I love invertebrate crabs. And also I love my children who I think of as invertebrate crabs. Yeah. So, but basically my whole right arm is devoted to my scientific endeavors. And so will eventually be a full sleeve with various organisms on it. So I intend to put all my study sites also on my body.
As you sort of move through your PhD and move a little bit further into it, what is your dream job or location in the future?
Well, I'd say my dream location is to not be in snowy, cold New England. I've been here forever. I'm born and raised here, and I really don't like the snow and I really don't like the cold. So my dream location would to be somewhere south, somewhere warm. My dream job is to stay within marine science, to do both research and teaching, like previously talked about diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think about all the people who have been the gatekeepers and door openers for me. I want to be able to do that for other people in the future. I think my dream job would be to work at some academic institution or some, you know, educational institution where I get to combine my passion of science and doing research and contributing to the greater body of knowledge while at the same time teaching the next generation of scientists, being the person to say, hey, you haven't had this experience. Why don't you come and do this research experience with me? Let's get you off onto your future. And so I just think a lot about my life and my future and my careers as being really thankful for the things that I have been afforded and wanting to pay that forward.
So our very last question, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
To think beyond themselves, to move out of like a me-centric thought process in regards to everything. So, you know, because I was thinking like, well, I could tell people to recycle, you know, be thinking about the earth, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle, think about climate change and what type of action you can take to decrease your carbon footprint so that you're not contributing to climate change, you know, thinking about that type of topic, but then also thinking about helping other people accomplish their goals or help other people who might be in the same boat as you are with your work, and all of those things really rely on us to come outside of ourselves and to not be so self-absorbed and self-centered, right? So to like think more about our environment, to think more about our community, to think more about the people we engage with on a day-to-day, to be really mindful of what goes on around us, to think outside of ourselves.
Allie, thank you so much for being here. It was such a pleasure chatting with you, and we really covered a lot of ground. If people want to connect with you online, where can they find you?
So they can find me on Twitter, Allie Putnam, AlyPutnam. I am also on Instagram and LinkedIn on all of those handles, Allie Putnam.
Thank you again. Thanks for being here. And thank you so much for listening. I want to remind everyone that we do now have a Patreon page for the show. So if you feel so inclined, head on over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast and check it out. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fishvecchio. The podcast is on Twitter at fisheriespod. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this 63rd episode of the Fishery Podcast. And remember, think beyond yourself. Thank you.
multiple people who make it work, and yet you're all spread throughout the country and it's still a cohesive show, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I've actually never met those guys at all.